in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, June 20th, 2014, and we're welcoming Bob Murphy back to the program. I guess by now you guys all know who Robert Murphy is. He's the author of many books. I've told you about a good many of them in the past. Right now we're talking about his little book, Chaos Theory, Two Essays in Market Anarchy. You can get that book at Amazon. You can get it through Amazon. Of course, if you're going to get it through Amazon, you'll also help the Tom Woods Show, right, by going to tomwoodsradio.com and entering Amazon from there and helping me pay the bills here. But you can get it that way, or you can get it for free. It's available online through the Mises Institute. We'll make sure and link to that in the show notes for this episode. Don't forget, you can use the archive to see all those show notes at tomwoodsradio.com. So right now, let's welcome Bob back to the program. Bob, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure, Tom.
I've been meaning to have you back on to finish up our discussion of chaos theory. Those of you who are coming to the program late, Bob has a book that I mentioned in the introduction called Chaos Theory. It's a little book. It's got two essays in it. It's from, what, 10 years ago? A little over 10 years ago now, right?
Yeah, I wrote it in grad school. Mm-hmm.
Wow, how about that? Okay, so this little book, I think, makes very important theoretical advances. So last time we looked at private law as part one, and part two is private defense. We want to think about, is it possible to conceive of these things in the absence of the state as we know it? Is it possible? And Bob is a great theorist of these things. Like, I'm not good at this. I'm good at reading what Bob writes and repeating it to people, but I'm not good at thinking up the sorts of things that Bob thinks up. But these are tricky and difficult questions. And before we get into them, I want to ask Bob, why should we even be speculating about this? I mean, doesn't it seem like, yeah, sure, there are wars and this and that, but for the most part, I mean, the present system works tolerably well. I mean, certainly well enough to justify us wanting to continue in it as opposed to wanting to try out a basically untried and dangerous-sounding alternative?
Well, as far as, you know, why should we consider the possibility of market anarchy or anarcho-capitalism or a voluntary society, whatever term you want to use to describe what we have in mind here, I think that's pretty obvious that, I mean, the state right now in its current historical form is the creator of all sorts of atrocities, and it's, you know, systematic theft, murder, and so forth. So that's, you know, locking up millions of people in the United States, you know, just for nonviolent drug offenses, things like that. So if we could get to a voluntary society, I mean, life would be unimaginably better. And so then why is it worthwhile focusing on this narrower question of, could you conceive of a privately funded military force? To me, the answer to that is, well, because that's one of the chief objections. You can talk to somebody who will sort of concede, okay, yeah, I guess in principle I could understand how your voluntary society would work, and we don't need a government-run mail delivery, we don't need the government to make roads, and I could even imagine private judges adjudicating if there's a, you know, a bank robber or something. Okay, but give me a break. If we had a society like that, we would just have a big target on us, and some neighboring state would take us over. And that is, like, the chief objection a lot of people have at the end of the day, and so that's why I think it's worthwhile to explain, no, on the contrary, organizing your region's military defense should also be left to voluntary, decentralized decisions and not placed in the hands of an elite group that monopolizes everything.
I will anticipate some of the objections to what you're about to say a little bit later, but why don't you give the positive overview of basically what this would look like?
Okay, as with all this stuff, you have to preface it by saying we don't know exactly how a free society would play out, and it wouldn't be the same scenario depending on the society we're dealing with. Just as freedom in the 1600s would have looked different from how it would look now. And so, but just to give broad sketches of how things might play out, I imagine an area such as the current United States with that sort of culture and economic development, technological abilities and financial institutions, that sort of arrangement, that infrastructure, if they were voluntarily fielding their own military defense, I think the main funding would come from insurance companies. And so the idea here is that insurance companies would have large policies. The owners of skyscrapers, for example, would take out policies in case there's fire damage, right? And so now the insurance company is going to indemnify the owner of that skyscraper if a major fire breaks out. And so the insurance company now has the incentive to make sure that there's not careless decisions being made, that, you know, that there's sprinklers installed and that the people aren't, you know, smoking and just throwing the cigarettes into the recycle bin full of the computer paper, things like that, right? They have smoke alarms installed. They have arrangements made with the fire department, which, of course, would also be privately owned in this world. All right, so that's pretty standard stuff, and we can see how that would work. And so if there's no state, though, that has a large military promising to defend the skyscraper from foreign invasion, I think insurance companies also would have clauses in their contracts about, well, gee, what happens if my property is destroyed or taken over by a foreign military power? Because that's a different type of threat from an earthquake or fire or what have you. And so then if the insurance companies are getting paid premiums for that sort of contingency, one way they can cover themselves is they can then go out and fund anti-aircraft missiles and put in a navy and ground troops and all the things that we normally think of as having to be funded by the government because there's an alleged free rider problem. I think actually, no, it would be concentrated in large insurance companies, at least for major urban areas where there's a lot of wealth concentrated, that there's a lot of rich people who would be writing big checks to fund premiums to cover themselves, and that's how I see the first pass at this.
So the analogy that you're drawing, I think, is an interesting and compelling one, that we all see that if there's some institution that is insuring somebody else against fire, that institution has a vested interest in making sure there aren't any fires and taking whatever reasonable steps can be taken to prevent fires. Well, likewise, if there's a policy against, even against burglary, well, then you'd want to prevent burglars from coming in. You'd install alarm systems and that sort of thing. Well, think of an invasion as being a whole bunch of really, really violent, heavily armed burglars. I mean, the principle is the same. It's just extended into areas in which we're not accustomed to seeing it. Now, what about the objection, though, that warlords would just take over? And I, of course, borrow that from the title of an article you wrote, perhaps as a follow-up to all this, Wouldn't Warlords Take Over? Walter Block is a huge fan of this article, and I'd like you to take a little time to explain how you respond to this nightmare scenario in which, instead of society being a peacefully self-regulating organism, it instead turns out to be the Hobbesian nightmare, and not so much a war of individuals against each other, but of just one war-making institution fighting against another, and that maybe it doesn't turn out to be a bunch of peacefully functioning insurance companies.
Okay. Well, first of all, I really think people, if they really want to get into it, should go Google that Robert Murphy Wooden Warlords Take Over and go see, if for nothing
right.
else, the people at Mises.org put the most amazing graphic to go with this article, so you don't want to miss that. But just for the purposes of you know this discussion, let me just hit some of the main points. Fundamentally, what I want to make sure everyone understands is the anarcho-capitalist or market anarchy, whatever you want to call it, voluntarist position, is not to say, oh, if you have a group of people and they embrace this philosophy, therefore no bad thing ever happens, and they're just going to live in what looks like utopia. That's not the claim. The claim is for a given group of people, you tell me what their level of ethics are or, you know, their commitment to non-aggression, how much they hate each other, if, you know, that they're willing to, they have clan disputes and they're willing to kill each other over the slightest offense. You specify all that up front. And then I am saying to give one group a monopoly power and give them a bunch of the guns will make things worse. All right, so I'm not saying that if it's decentralized and no group has the power of what we now call is, you know, the state, that that means they're going to be peace-loving. What I'm saying is creating a state does not enhance the chance for peace. And so in particular, the sort of person who says, yeah, I've considered your perspective here, you anarchist, but, you know, I really don't trust it. I think there'd be a bunch of warlords in that sort of environment, and so that's why instead I want to have a state with nice periodic elections every 2 to 4 years to pick the group of people who will be totally in charge and will have nuclear weapons and tanks at their disposal. And so I'm saying if the world, if the population is civil enough and can respect the outcome of a democratic election and can say, oh, let's have a constitution because we don't want the majority to be able to oppress the minority, if it's that sort of people such that a limited state would work, well, then anarcho-capitalism would work even better. Okay, so I'm not saying anarcho-capitalism would never lead to mayhem and chaos in the pejorative sense of the term, but I'm saying the sort of people for whom anarcho-capitalism wouldn't work, a so-called democracy would be even worse. And just to give one empirical example, I mean, people look at Somalia, you know, that's the standard put down. They say, oh, yeah, you like your ideas, why don't you go move to Somalia? But you know what? Somalia had a state, too, and it was even more vicious than what happened during the period of warlords, okay, because those people do not have a respect for life. They go around killing each other, a lot of them do. You know, they will resort to violence at the drop of a hat. And so that's why it was particularly brutal when they had somebody in charge running a state, and that's why the state fell, because it was so awful. So as bad as Somalia was under the brief period of genuine statelessness before, you know, outside powers came in and kind of set a proxy state, in that brief period, yeah, don't get me wrong, I didn't want to live there. I'd rather live in New Hampshire. But the point is that was better than it had been under their government ruler.
Well, that's an interesting point that I think needs to be raised in many, many contexts. People will look at what conditions were like during the Industrial Revolution and just assume that they must have been worse. This must represent a retrogression. But compared to what? Not compared to today or compared to an ideal situation, but compared to what came before, compared to the plausible alternative or the actually existing alternative. In that case. Now, what about somebody, though, who would say, you know, Murphy, some of this sounds plausible, but what I can't seem to get my head around is the idea that Hitler invades and State Farm is going to take care of me.
Okay, yeah, it's a great objection. And at first, that sounds great. And it's, you know, I don't know if somebody actually said this to me or if I just brought it up as a sort of possible objection. But you can imagine, you know, I get up and give my little spiel about, and the insurance companies do this, and that's market clearing. And, da, da, da. And then someone says, yeah, that all sounds good until it faces, you know, Hitler's division of panzers or something like that, right? And it just seems like that's a real world, like, ooh, sorry, sit down, try again. But you know what? There were a bunch of states that tried to defend themselves against Hitler, including the French government with the Maginot Line, and that didn't work out very well either. So does that prove that, therefore, state-organized military defense is obviously an utter failure because it couldn't withstand the might of Nazi Germany? Right, so yeah, don't get me wrong, a group of 1,000 anarchists living in the forest would not have been able to repel an invasion from Hitler at the peak of his power, but by the same token, plenty of states couldn't repel the might of Nazi Germany either. And so the question always is a relative one, that if you have a group of people, so let me put it this way, the population of France with their resources and the amount of technology they had and so on, had they been organized in a decentralized manner and didn't put all their eggs in one basket, so to speak, I think they would have been able to withstand the onslaught of Nazi Germany. But they didn't because they foolishly organized their military defense under the auspices of a state where a few commanders, you know, thought they had learned the lessons of World War I and organized their defense accordingly and didn't give the freedom to decentralized groups to try different things.
What about the objection that there's a risk that an institution that is providing military defense morphs into a state?
Well, I love Rothbard's response to that. You know, and just more generally, you could say, hey, you know, these private legal agencies, police forces, whatever, who's to say they wouldn't morph into a state? And Rothbard, I'm not making it as eloquent as he did, but he said something along the lines of, you know, this is really interesting that because there's a possibility that the system we're proposing 40 years from now could morph into a state and how horrible that would be, we want to just create the state right now. And,
right.
And you know, that's sort of odd. Now, in fairness, the claim is, oh, no, come on, guys, if we create the state right now, we can be sure that it has checks and balances and, you know, we can draft up a constitution and have divided powers and things like that. You know, bicameral legislature, you know how well that's worked out in practice, you know. And this kind of goes back to the earlier point about the what if warlords would take over. What I'm saying is, if you have a population for which that kind of system would work, that we can create a limited government and we trust that people wouldn't just, when they get a brief majority, put their guys in power and oppress everybody else, well, then how come those people would continue to patronize a defense agency that started getting too big for its britches, right? So originally, you've got 10 competing defense agencies. The tanks are all split up among different companies that are technically in competition with each other. And so then the fear is that, well, no, what if because of economies of scale, or, you know, one company just has, you know, just started gaining market share, and then after a while they become unstoppable. Well, if the customers in that society are too stupid to see that coming, and they don't mind that this one company keeps violating contracts and they keep sending their checks in because they're afraid or whatever, well, then why would that same group of people be able to restrain a state from doing the same thing and becoming tyrannical? Right, so it's not that this is some hypothetical worry that states grow beyond their original mandate and then end up oppressing people. That happens all the time throughout history. And so, it's odd that because we're worried that these competing agencies might eventually do something comparable, that we just rush right to the thing that we know won't work.
I have been persuaded by the argument from legitimacy that the state, through its education and various means of propaganda, has gotten us to believe certain things about it that we would not be inclined to believe about an insurance company or a private institution. So we think this institution can get away with all kinds of enormities that we would consider moral outrages if perpetrated by any other institution, because it's the state, it has sovereignty, or war is hell, or whatever the excuse is. We get these excuses, we get these rationalizations, and we imbibe them, we internalize them, and we treat the state differently than we treat all other institutions because we think it's legitimate, it's okay, the state is an exception. But nobody ever said, you know, Allstate, or State Farm, or Progressive, these things are exceptions to the rule. No one would think that. It would be very difficult, if not impossible, to get people to say, well, yeah, I know tanks are rolling down the middle of the street, but, you know, this institution has sovereignty, and that magic word makes everything okay. People would be much, much more likely to resist when they haven't been propagandized and indoctrinated for 12 years that the existing system is divinely ordained, or whatever the excuse of the day is.
Yeah, that's a great point, and you're right. And I think actually, even though those of us who are fans of laissez-faire capitalism, it might bother us sometimes. We think that people are almost too picky. You know, somebody just gets mad about, oh my gosh, my fries at McDonald's were soggy. I hate them.
Yeah,
you know,
right. But it would help in this case, wouldn't it?
Right. Yeah. So that's actually a healthy attitude. You're right. They're far more, jealous of their rights or you know, their prerogatives and so forth, and are far more suspicious about other people when they work for a private company, whereas that all goes out the window for the average American when it comes to government officials. But beyond that, I think, and that's a great point that you raise, that there is this issue of legitimacy, whereas that if private companies started expanding and actually violating contracts and just behaving like genuine criminals, that would be crystal clear. Whereas you're right, that there's this aura of exemption that, well, no, state officials are allowed to do things that would be criminal if you or I did them, or employees of a private company. But beyond that, just I think there's something perverse about the monopoly that the state enjoys. So, for example, when the local police, you know, let's say they're taking somebody into custody and the guy's not armed, or, you know, some teenager, some 16-year-old kid, and he mouths off to the cops, and they break his arm while they're arresting him, and people catch it on their iPhones or whatever, and the video goes viral. What happens? You get people in the comments on the internet, you know, some people are saying, oh my gosh, thug, you know, you pig, but then you always get people saying, well, no, you know, I when someone's breaking into your house, so you're not going to call the cops? Right, and so that what people do is they end up saying, this is the price we have to pay, these occasional oversteps or mistakes, to have law and order. And the reason they're saying that is because they think you need police. But if instead there were private competing security agencies, and that, you know, some mall was hiring Company A, whereas another mall down the street was hiring Company B, and Company A's employees systematically broke people's arms when they were stopping them from shoplifting, there wouldn't be that, you know, oh, well, geez, well, we need to have security. No, you just say, well, fire those people and hire Company B because their officers are better trained. They don't break people's arms when they're just, you know, grabbing teenagers from shoplifting. And so I think that knee-jerk defense of you know, clearly officials acting with excessive force, that would fall away because you'd have competition and you would see, well, no, you don't need to choose between complete lawlessness or having teenagers have their arms broken when they're just mouthing off to a security agent.
Bob, the other day there was an author on, I don't know if it was, I think it probably was Salon, it might have been Slate, and I read an annoying article of his, and I don't know why I wasted my time, but then I went on his Twitter feed, and he thinks he's really cheeky because he's, you know, he's against the Iraq war. That takes a lot of courage, of course. And he says, especially in 2014, he says, but, you know, we may have to go back in because, you know, Iraq was our, well, I'll use the word screw up. So, you know, we might have some responsibility for it. So even now, even a guy who sees the pure criminality of the Iraq war and how horrible it was, he still uses the word we to describe it. He still, in a spiritual sense, identifies with the whole thing. He still talks about we and our. Whereas if it were a case where you had a variety of institutions, there's no way you would think we and our. You would absolutely and automatically say they, which is such a central insight.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's like, you know, Tom, don't you feel just so horrible how about 20 years ago, remember when we burned that old lady's lap with the coffee we served her at McDonald's?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Should we pay her reparations for that? That we did that to her?
I know. Yeah, because it was located within the physical boundaries of roughly where we live. So therefore, it's insane. Now, but before I let you go, there's one thing you mentioned earlier that's a little bit off topic, but as long as you're on with us, I'd like to get your thoughts on it. Actually, no, I have two things. One is the fire department. The usual view would be that, well, in a free market, of course, if you didn't pay your fire insurance premium or whatever, the fire department's just going to stand there and not do anything, and then other houses are going to burn and everything else. I think people are thinking about the case of Crassus in ancient Rome, where he was the richest guy in Rome, and if your house was on fire, he would come and offer to put out the fire if you would sell it to him for pennies on the dollar. Otherwise, if you let it sit there and burn, you'll get nothing. So what he was improving consumer welfare by making offers like that. So isn't he the great example of a free market firefighter?
Yeah, I mean, this stuff is tricky, and it interacts with our views, you know, our Christian views and whatever, and it's certainly true. You know, you see someone who's really down and out, and you can imagine someone offering them a voluntary thing that technically makes them better off, but you think in terms of Christian charity or whatever, they come out, you shouldn't do that. You should help the guy out and not, you know, have him sell 3 years of his labor to you or something for the next meal. He needs to avoid starvation. So I guess what I would say is, yeah, it is true, narrowly construed, that given the options available, that rich guy making that offer is improving those people's circumstances. And so long as he wasn't doing something behind the scenes to sabotage other potential avenues of relief that they could have gotten, you know what I mean? Like if he's bribing the senators or something such that he's making sure the only option you have if your house catches on fire is to pay him or to sell your property to him for pennies on the dollar, well, then, of course, he's initiating aggression, and that's bad. But it is true that, you know, he's certainly helping it more than anybody else in society is, right? That the other people who just lament that and shake their heads and move on with their day, I mean, they weren't doing anything to put out the fire either. And if there were some people willing to do that, well, then he would lose his bargaining power. You know, if there were bucket brigades standing at the ready to go help people out and just charge them a small fee for their labor, well, then that wouldn't happen. So you have to wonder. I mean, I confess I have not gone and researched that historically, but I wonder how could that have persisted? You know, did they not know that houses could catch on fire and they were just walking around bumbling and he was the one guy? And if he were the one guy who realized that, well, then he's a genius and that's why he, you know, earned so much wealth, is because he was the guy who forecasted and realized, oh, you know, actually combustible things can burn. All right, so there's so much packed into that story that I really don't know what to make of it. Certainly in a modern society, that could not possibly be the long-term equilibrium where people just sit around and take no steps and there's no competition to defend from a fire. You would have, you know, contracts that you would sign beforehand that would say, okay, yeah, there's like a local agency that has a few trucks or whatever, and there would, you know, be hydrants located around and so forth, and the people building new housing developments, that would all be taken into consideration. So this idea that you're going to go build a whole subdivision and sell homes for $250,000 to middle-class people, And then, oh my gosh, we didn't even think a house could catch on fire. Who could have ever anticipated that? And then the people are going to be caught there, and that's the first time they're going to worry about it. I mean, that's just absurd. That's not going to happen in a modern industrialized society.
Bob, there was one other thing I was going to ask, but I think I'll hold off till the next time we have you on. I had somebody who, on my Facebook page, said, can you have somebody come on and explain, do a show on the differences between the Austrian school and the supply siders? And I don't think we need to do a whole show. We'll just do a show where I throw some questions at you and you answer them. We could probably handle that right now, but we might as well keep this episode topical, and that one won't take too long. But this is actually just a shout-out to that guy. I haven't forgotten to ask your question, but we'll do it when we're back to talking about more traditional economic topics. So, Bob, I'm going to link people in the show notes to this episode for this week. You can use the archive at tomwoodsradio.com. There's a drop-down menu to find any particular episode. And so for this episode, we'll link to not only where you can buy Chaos Theory, but also where you can read it online for free, thanks to the great benefactor of the human race, the Mises Institute. So, Bob, before I let you go, though, I will ask you to tell us about what's going on in Nashville on August 15th.
Well, sure thing. So, everybody, I would invite you to come to Nashville August 15th, 2014, as Tom says. It's called A Night of Clarity, and this is an annual event that my business partner and I put on. And we just bring in a slew of speakers to talk about the nation's financial predicament from the perspective of Austrian economics. You've got Larry Reed of the Foundation for Economic Education. You got Nelson Nash. You got I'm going to talk, and then Tom Woods is going to come. And then the headliner this year is David Stockman, former budget director under Ronald Reagan, who can certainly discuss the differences between Austrian economics and conventional supply side and show why it is that actually, you really need to study from the Austrian perspective to understand exactly what's going on and why the Federal Reserve is out of control. So the theme this year is capitalism versus corporatism. You hear a lot of talk about how we have a free market society and that the Republicans are all for limited government, and we'll see that that's actually not true. So the website for everybody is nightofclarity.com. Hope you can check it out.
It's been great every year that I've been there. It is indeed a wonderful event. And I urge people to join us there. I'll be there for a couple of days. It goes on the 15th and the 16th, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, the main event is Friday night, the 15th, and then, yeah, there's a follow-up workshop on the 16th.
Right. But most people will be there for the event on the 15th. Plus, Nashville's just a fun place to visit. If you're coming from out of town, you might as well make a weekend out of it. So I'm looking forward to that, Bob. And, of course, I'll see you sooner than that. I'll see you at the Mises University program next month. But I hope to see you, so to speak, on this program sometime before then. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks again, Bob. All right, everybody, make sure you are following Bob at consultingbyrpm.com. Bob is very much worth following. He's got very, very substantial blog posts, like full of interesting information, and of course, Bob's wit. So it's definitely worth putting in your RSS feed, consultingbyrpm.com/blog. All right, I haven't worked out the whole schedule for next week, but we'll definitely be talking to Anthony Gregory. We'll definitely be talking to David Stockman, and I will scrounge up a few more programs for you guys. We'll get some more great guests, and I'll try and do at least one program next week on my own. It's just hard because I'm balancing so many different things these days. The Ron Paul Homeschool Program, check that out at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And I am putting together a new book, as I mentioned last week. So I got a lot to juggle, but I'm going to try and do at least one show on my own next week because people keep saying to me, we love your guests, they're wonderful guests, but once in a while you should do the show by yourself. You're absolutely right, and I'll do much, much more of that when the Ron Paul Homeschool Program is all finished. I did get a neat compliment, by the way, and forgive me if I've told you guys this already. My short-term memory is not what it once was, but I was talking to a guy I know reasonably well, we were talking in person, who said that he's been listening to the program regularly and he loves the guests. And he says, you know, I haven't heard of 90% of these people, and yet they just keep on coming. It's week after week, it's more and more and more people I've never heard of who are all great. And it's wonderful to see that there are so many good people out there who are able to articulate this message so effectively. That's exactly what I'm trying to do with the show, is to highlight a lot of people you might not have been familiar with otherwise, but whom you should be familiar with, and I hope you're glad now that you are familiar with. So thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe at TomWoodsRadio.com. You can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or any old place you'd like to subscribe where you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.